SF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
January 6th. Thank God I'm Canadian. Dad got sick. Thank God I'm Canadian. Trump is back? Thank God I'm Canadian. Roe v. Wade overturned. Thank God I'm Canadian. Another school shooting. Thank God I'm Canadian. You've said it. I've said it too. And I mean it. Thank God. And that's about as emotional as I get about this country. It's about as deep as my patriotic feelings go. Insert shitty American thing here. Thank God I'm Canadian. But is that really enough? I mean, especially considering the fact that we just usually end up doing some milder version of whatever America does anyhow, you know, 4 or 5 years later. Because that's what we do.
Ron DeSantis denounced the upcoming World Economic Forum.
All these elites come in, they run everything.
My ministers will be banned from participating in the World Economic Forum when I'm in government.
When you report fake news, you are the enemy of the people.
When journalists asked about PPC connections to the alt-right, Bernier published their email addresses.
Everything woke turns to shit.
Enough with the woke shit.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats. We will never give up. You'll never take back our country with weakness. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
They do Obama, we do Trudeau. They do Trump, we do Poilievre. They do Fox, we do Rebel. Our shootings follow theirs. But less frequently, you say. That's not a lot of comfort if you were one of the people at that mosque. Okay, but what about healthcare? Our sacrosanct healthcare? Well, what are we doing to it right now? We're Americanizing it. Privatizing it. Look, the world has begun some massive kind of transition, and anybody who tells you how it's all going to shake out is deluded or lying to you or both. But what I can say with confidence is that if you think our wide, unprotected, imaginary border is going to save us from whatever shit show is roiling just a few miles south of us, if you think our mild little middle power is somehow immune to the thrashings and crashings of the most powerful empire in human history, you're dreaming. So, what's the plan? Well, have no fear, because an American is here today with answers. Well, a former American. Rob Goodman was a speechwriter in the U.S. House and Senate. Now he's an assistant professor of politics at Toronto Metropolitan University, where he teaches and writes about populism, rhetoric, and the history of political thought. He's got a new book called Not Here, Why American Democracy is Eroding and How Canada Can Protect Itself. And he joins me here in our Toronto studio in a minute. Wait for it.
Part of the reason I wrote this book is because I want to issue an early warning. I want Canadians to realize to the extent possible that this is a real problem. It's a real threat. And the kind of democratic erosion we're seeing in the U.S., the kind of political dysfunction we've seen in the U.S., there's no reason that those same forces couldn't come here to Canada. In fact, in many ways, they already are.
So it's not really, not here. It's more of like, not here, please.
Well, a lot of people have asked me, like, what the proper inflection for reading the title is. And I guess I'd have to say that it changes every time I look at it. Sometimes I'm feeling very defiant and very much like a good Canadian nationalist, and I say, not here. And then other times, it's exactly the way you described it. It's a more fearful not here. And that just changes based on what's going on in the news. It changes based on my mood. It changes based on what's on the front page of the CBC or the New York Times. But I guess at the end of the day, I would say one way to explain it is, you know, not here if we're really committed to not here. Not here if we really get our act together and realize there's still time to shore up what's left of Canadian democracy.
I think that to figure out what our strengths are is going to also take some examination. And when I cracked open your book and it started with an examination of Z versus Z, I was like, oh boy, not here is going to be tricky. You're right that it seems laughable that the letter Z, I say Z, or the Queen or the Quarter could save us. Later on, there's some conversation about Coffee Crisp. And there are days somehow that it seems as if these trivial differences might save us. How? How could, it's so thin. It is so weak. How could those things save us?
No, you're absolutely right. And that's the thing that I struggle with trying to be a new Canadian, recognizing that our political problems and our political system and our political culture, and notice that I'm saying are, because I take it seriously that we've moved here for good. I think of myself as an immigrant. I think of myself as someone who is raising a family and putting down roots here. I think those differences at the same time seem very real and sometimes very insubstantial. To live in Canada is to be exposed to an onslaught of American culture, American politics, American news, American geopolitical fear, all these sorts of things that are part of the nature of living in a country 10 times smaller than your biggest military ally, biggest trading partner, biggest source of culture and news and so on. So I really get that it's an uphill struggle. But I guess part of the reason I hold on to these things, even though they're a very thin reed, is just from my own psychological perspective, I need something to convince myself that there is an alternate future possible here, that there's enough in the way of Canadian difference that we can latch onto in order to say that the same kind of forces causing American democracy to degrade, the same kind of forces that have brought Trumpism and the far right to power and possibly to return to power very soon, don't have to play out the same way. And those little cultural differences, those silly little things like the way you pronounce the letter in the alphabet, Coffee Crisp bar, different people on our coinage, that sort of thing. You know, at the end of the day, of course, these things are all symbolic. But yeah, symbols really matter. Symbols really help us gather up a sense of our identity. And part of the reason I latched onto the Z is because this is a thing that for me is really associated with my kids. I talk about in the book how I've been singing the ABC song as sort of a bedtime routine for my kids since our oldest was born, more than 8 years ago now. When we started singing that song, and she was born in New York when we were living there and I was a grad student, in W, X, Y, and Z, when we moved it over here to Canada, first to Montreal and then to Toronto, where our home is now, I figured, well, we're here now. I better change it to W, X, Y, and Z. And part of the reason I held on to that was because it's just this little sort of daily reminder that you're in a different place where things don't have to play out. And just psychologically for me, the anger, the stress, the fear, all the things that we're going through watching U.S. politics, these little differences have been a bit of a psychological refuge to me. And I know that they can be silly, and I know that that's not really much to hang a politics on. But at points in time, it's worked for me. And I certainly don't think that that's an actual kind of substantive solution, but it's something to build on, the sense of difference or identity, that when we look a little bit more about the political culture and history of these two countries, can become a little more substantial. But for me, it was just a place to start.
Do we have enough beyond those little symbols to actually construe of ourselves as something different enough to know what it is we are protecting? And that does bring us to this question of nationalism, which is a really tricky one when you add the word Canadian to it. Like, Canadian nationalism almost, like, it's like an oxymoron. And there's a catch-22, because the thing that I like most about being Canadian, we did this kind of a joke book, but I kind of meant the jokes. When I was promoting the book, I said, I'm proud to live in a nation that is ashamed of being nationalistic. You write about nationalism and pride. And pride seems like a completely anti-Canadian feeling. I don't want to feel more proud of, like, my nation state. And I think that when we're only just reckoning with things that we should be ashamed of, like rightfully ashamed, to just reckon with the fact of unmarked graves of Indigenous children should make us ashamed at a time when perhaps we need to find our pride. And we can only be proud to the extent that we don't know about, that we kept ourselves in the dark about that. You write about this very explicitly, and I love this. You write that pride in one's country needs ignorance in the way that crops need shit. So how do you circle that square? How do you get to a form of Canadianness that inures us, that like makes us have a shared sense of what it is that we're protecting from, whatever it's the rise of fascism or whatever the hell it is that we're talking about that is popping up in the States? How do we get our act together? Do we need to be better patriots? Do we need to be nationalistic Canadians?
Well, I don't think that's quite what I'd suggest in the book. And I think it's complicated for all the reasons you pointed out, for the reason that pride in nation and nationhood is not a very Canadian feeling. And I think that's pretty well attested in history. And also the fact that this is just a multinational place. When you say Canadian nationalism or a Canadian nation, people inevitably ask, which nation are we talking about? English Canada or French Canada or the indigenous nations that were here before settlers? Like, all these things mean that Canadian nationalism is, as you say, a really hard circle to square. So part of the reason that I go down a different route in this book is exactly for that reason, that I think it's really hard to both know one's history, and I don't think that's just the case for Canada or for the U.S. or for any settler colonies. You know, history is ugly. History is full of mass death. History is full of genocide. That's very much the case here as it is anywhere else. So I think pride's a really tricky thing to sell. And rightfully so. And I feel that especially as someone who thinks of myself as someone on the left. I think the right has had an easier time embracing notions of nationalism or the nation or pride in the fatherland or all these sort of kind of quasi-fascist sort of ideas, because they're a lot more consonant with the way the right thinks about the world. But as someone who doesn't want to think about the world that way, how can we still think about what's worth preserving in this country's history of democracy and democratic traditions? You know, so one of the things I do in the book is sometimes I say, well, let's put nationalism aside. Let's just use the word localism. And I get that just changing a word doesn't change a history, and changing a word isn't an argument.
It changes the feeling, though. It changes the feeling. Like how people feel about Montreal, the people who live in Montreal, or how people feel about their neighborhood does stir some of those feelings. This is my community, and I give a shit about it. And I think it's easier for us to get there than it is to, like this is my country, damn it. That's like, it makes me feel weird.
Yeah, for sure. It's concrete in a way that maybe pride in one's country isn't. And I think that, you know, just think about the root of the word. And this is a dorky point, but nationalism comes from the word for birth. You're born in a certain place. You're born as a certain kind of people. Localism comes from the word for place. It's connected to a sense of where you are, a sense of belonging, a sense of the history in a place, a sense of being part of a place that could theoretically be really expansive. And I think Canada has been more expansive than in most places. So what I'm beginning from, and I think a lot of people on the left struggle with this, is this idea that it's okay and normal to be attached to where you find yourself or where you're from or where you live. But I think especially in Canada, a country that whose sense of identity is really under this constant barrage of American culture, this sense of pride in our place or valuing our place without glossing over the ugly parts of the history can be a way of filtering the sort of influences that come into this country, saying that, you know, this sort of hyperpolarization or this sort of right nationalism or xenophobic politics, these things aren't really authentically of this place. They're not part of us. We can stigmatize them in a certain way as not part of the story we want to tell about ourselves. And is it always an objective story? I don't think politics is made up of objective stories. One thing I talk about is the idea that politics is made up of myths, a lot of myths. And that doesn't mean that myths are falsehoods or that myths are ways of lying. Myths are just common stories that we use to orient ourselves in politics, to do collective work together. And the myths that we tell about ourselves and about our history here can be ones that help us be better at democracy or ones that make democracy even harder. So I guess what I'm trying to do in the book is pull together. And I say pull together because I don't think you can make up a myth from scratch, but pull together the resources in the political history of this place, both the good parts and the bad parts, that show why there's authentic reason to believe that democratic erosion might not happen here in the way that it's happened in the U.S. And that's, I think, the best that we can do. There's no certainty here. There's no assurance that it's not going to happen here. But I do think the stories we tell about ourselves matter. I think they have to be honest stories. I don't think they can be stories that gloss over things like indigenous genocide, things like the history of settler colonialism in this country. I think those are very much a part of the way I see this country's past, and I write about that in the book. But I also think that this is a country that's been much more open to the idea that there isn't just one real people here, that there isn't just one people that gets to define what it means to be Canadian. You know, so when you go back to that point where you said that you're proud to be part of a country that's embarrassed of nationalism, or however exactly you phrased it, I think that I see Canada in a very similar way, except I want to be a little more explicit about that because I think it can really help Canadians push back against what's beginning to happen in this country.
So we need better myths and more constructive myths, and you write that we need to get better at self-mythologizing. And I know what you mean. It's kind of frustrating when what we do here is tell stories from Canada, and it's interesting what happens to a lot of people when you start telling a story. And in the same way that you could tell a story and the character, like, you know, emerges from Grand Central Station and has this mythological status, as soon as you say they pass the CN Tower, they're like, boring. Like, it's a strange self-loathing prejudice that just immediately classifies anything Canadian. And I'm guilty of it as anyone else, even though I'm cursed to tell these stories and try to get people engaged with them. I mean, they're amazing stories. And then you have this uphill battle as soon as you mention Canada. I get that. I get the need to get over that somehow. And yet when you do bring up some things that are more meaningful and substantial than a coffee crisp bar, you talk about things like how we have fewer guns, how our kids are marginally less likely to be crushed under student debt or health care bills. You're right, it's the excellent public schools, which is an overstatement. They're just not as bad as the public schools in America. Everything that you write that is substantial is in comparison to how much worse it is in America. So is that, like, how we're going to do this? Just, like, how are we going to carve out a new mythology or a sense of ourselves or figure out what we protect? Because if all we are is, as you write, what we refuse, and historically, all we've refused is to be quite as bad as the States, because we do what they do, we just don't do it quite to the same extent. Is that going to be enough, or do we need to actually figure something different entirely out?
Mm-hmm. First of all, I think you need to be secure in your differences before you can actually build on them. I don't want a world where Canada is consistently looking over its shoulder and saying, at least we're not the U.S., at least our democracy isn't eroding like the U.S. And I think if we can be secure in that, then it's easier to reach for more. That dynamic really does infuriate me. So I do want something more substantial. And I guess part of what is more substantial to me is when I think about the political dynamics of this country and of, you know, the rich democracies around the world, they have all had public spheres that have been hollowed out by neoliberalism, by the retreat of the public sphere, by pulling back on social programs that improve people's lives, by pulling back on public goods, by the decline of labor unions. All these things have happened all across the rich democracies, all over the world. And of course, you know, they happen at different rates. I think I said to someone else the other day, well, we're all sinking. We're just kind of sinking at different rates. But I do think that one difference is that in Canada, we've had a sort of stronger set of social goods in more recent living memory. And I think that's something to mobilize around. I think it's something that, you know, when Doug Ford threatens to revoke collective bargaining rights and override the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, that people showed up like crazy. The QP education workers shut down Queen's Park. There are tens of thousands of people there. You know, organized labor could credibly threaten they were going to escalate to a general strike, which is like unheard of. And it was believable enough that Ford backed down. These kinds of things, I think, happen where there's a bit more of an institutional memory of what it was like to have a bit more of a functional public sphere, a bit more functional public goods, a bit more functional organized labor. And all these sorts of things, again, don't make Canada categorically different than any other country in the world, but there's something to build on. There are things that have not quite got to the point of erosion that they are in the U.S. So no, if Canada is consistently patting itself on the back on not coming in last place in whatever horrible chart it is of the week, if that's another result of my book, I will not be very happy about it. But if a result of the book can be to say, you know, look, we have a lot of resources that have built a successful, meaningful, effective public sphere that had social programs that were in many ways the envy of the world. There's no reason other than political will why we can't rebuild these sorts of things. And I think one thing that we have going for us that the U.S. doesn't is more living memory. There are more people alive who remember what it was like to have more functional health care, transit, education systems. You can go on down the list. I think that's a time-limited resource, and that's part of my sense of urgency is, again, there's nothing categorical that means that Canada isn't going to see a similar erosion of these public goods, but I value them so much, not just because my kids are in public school, not just because we play at the park down the street every day or at least every weekend and enjoy the free ice skating rink and all these sorts of things. It's because all these things are training grounds for democracy. They're where you meet your neighbors. They're where you practice preserving things in common. They're where you can come together with other people and not have to constantly status check yourself and check your income and your profession and your whatever kinds of barriers of entry that human beings set up around one another. Public goods are one of the few places in the world where those things don't apply quite as much. And they're not incidental to democracy. They're not a kind of thing that's nice to have, but kind of separate from the main issue of democratic erosion. You know, democracy, I think, erodes because these sorts of public goods that help us practice democracy have been eroding for so long.
I want to take this into a more practical kind of a conversation because, you know, these are interesting topics like to discuss. Could we be, you know, building on the social safety net that we, if that's what we pride ourselves on, could we be doing better? And should we, what do we base our national identity on? But they can get a bit abstract, and we're talking about an urgent situation. It's very possible that Trump will win again. You write about authoritarianism that it has its own glamour and appeal, and slowly and steadily, without any of us explicitly acknowledging its influence, and many of us loudly disclaiming it, it will shape our sense of what is possible here and what is permissible here. We've seen this happen. We're seeing it happen. Just as sort of Trudeau follows Obama as our version of a neoliberal centrist, Poilievre, some years later, steps in as the, you know, the Canadian version, a bit of a milder version of a Trump. And what are we going to do then? Because when you tell me the solution is to reject these things, to return to our conception of ourselves as some kind of lesser version of a Scandinavian country and build on those things to be more unlike the United States, and really almost like, I don't want to exaggerate here, but to deny, like, hey, it's all myths anyhow. So let's deny that this populist right-wing stuff is a part of us. Mm-hmm. And let's choose the other myth and build on that myth. That strikes me, I saw that happen. I saw center-left Canada deny what was happening with the Freedom Convoy. I saw people say, oh, this is all foreign-funded. It's not really us. These people, they don't even know who we are. They're citing the First Amendment. There are foreign actors. They're really a conspiracy theory. And there was significant foreign funding, but most of the funding came from Canada. To deny the existence of that movement, to deny the existence of that grievance, to deny that while you and I may agree that there's no such thing as like a real Canadian, those people knew what a real Canadian was. Mm-hmm. They had a very clear idea of who the real Canadian was and how the real Canadian was getting over and the real Canadian wasn't going to take it anymore. Is the way through this to pretend like that didn't happen or that it wasn't us or that it was somehow imposed upon us or to accept that that is with us? Yes, it's heavily influenced by American media as everything here is, but it's real. It's true. Those people exist and we cohabitate this country and we're not... They're rejecting the mythology, and they're rejecting the personification of that mythology, Justin Trudeau, because they reject him as empty and as proof that those ideals and that myth is empty.
Mm-hmm. So, look, I think you're absolutely right that these forces are part of Canadian political life. Of course, there are plenty of Canadians here that want to say that we, us, defined in terms of race, religion, ethnicity, language, however you want to define it, are the real ones, and the rest you can get the hell out. Of course, that's a real political force, and I don't think I'd ever deny that. But I guess there are a couple of things that I want to say in response. The first is I still am really struck by the way in which there's this sort of contradiction in terms in the Canadian far right and the way it presents itself, which is I'm just blown away by how much it both wants to embrace a sense of Canadianness and Canadian identity and yet does it through the use of symbols that are overwhelmingly derived from the international and mainly the U.S. far right. And I think that's a contradiction in terms that we can and should call out. You know, the other day I saw one of those giant pickup trucks with an F. Trudeau sticker on it and also a Punisher flag. I see all those Punisher flags in the U.S. all the time, which are sort of a symbol of rah-rah for police violence, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. Now, in the U.S., it's decorated like an American flag. Well, I saw a Punisher flag on the back of a pickup truck decorated in a Canadian flag. And I guess part of the reason I see that as a contradiction in terms is not that, like, you know, Punisher flags aren't Canadian or authentically Canadian, because what does that even mean? But it's this symbol that is derived from another political culture. It gets a kind of, you know, the paint swapped out and pasted on a new pickup truck that's made in one of the same factories that makes that U.S. pickup truck. And I guess I have a hard time seeing the right in Canada try to make a case for its sort of authentic nationalism while using these symbols that are very transnational and many times
super
American.
Interesting. Yeah. They're laying claim to being the real Canadians, while their shtick is just so lame. It's just a completely borrowed and reapplied shtick.
I mean, bro, you just changed the paint on it, and I just
So when you say stigmatize it, I mean that probably is the place to start. Like it's almost like more persuasive than on the grounds that we should be going the other way. It's just like, let's have some made in Canada fascism. I mean, like, you know, get some creativity for God's sakes. I'll say this about Americans. They will call themselves Democrats. Mm-hmm. They will call themselves Republicans. We don't say that. Like, unless you're like into it. I'm a proud capital C conservative. I'm a proud member of the Liberal Party of Canada. You're really talking about a hobby of a minority in Canada, whereas it is part of American political culture. You talk about the disappearance of the public sphere and how, you know, we have arguably a better one to preserve. I don't know about that, man. Like, you know, it's hard enough in the States to get people to care about news. Our job here is to get that news reading, listening audience to care about Canadian news. And that audience would rather pay attention to American news. The public sphere in Canada is incredibly weak. You were talking earlier about how, like, you know, yeah, people showed up and Labour showed up to fight Doug Ford. I have often thought that Americans will show up and fight back a lot harder than Canadians when push comes to shove, because while the general consensus might be center-left, it's soft center-left, and it's almost more oriented towards American issues, center-left. And center-left is not a movement. It's just kind of like a vague sense of yourself as having better health care. And, you know, like, yeah, I guess I'll put up with higher taxes for that.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's why I'm trying to galvanize people that they need to keep showing up like that. Because, yeah, if you say what you will about American political dysfunction, one thing that has been really heartening and impressive to me is how much Americans have shown up and fought back. I was at, I want to say it was... It was one of the New York airports. It was LaGuardia or JFK on the day Trump announced the infamous Muslim ban. And people showed up and turned out. People rode the subways there. People were there to demonstrate against these religiously bigoted immigration restrictions that came in, you know, a couple of days after Trump took power. And I was really proud to be a part of that and show up. You know, of course, it was a long struggle to push back against that. And that didn't make anything happen overnight. But one of the things I think comes out in the book is that although I'm really critical of how American political culture has got to this point, in many ways the heroes of my book are people like W.E.B. Du Bois, who have pointed out the dynamics that have pushed American politics in these authoritarian directions, and the people that have been at the forefront of the freedom struggle, especially in America, the black freedom struggle, which is where a lot of impetus for American democracy comes from. And yeah, Canada has a different history. And Canada, I think, rightly or wrongly, sees itself as a place where we don't need to, you know, fight back quite as much and in the same way. I do think that's going to change. You mentioned this question of myths a second ago, and also sort of in connection with, are we going to have a conservative government? And, you know, it's not really going to matter what story people tell about themselves when the conservatives are in power or running things. And I guess that's true, but part of the way I'd push back is by saying, you know, the stories we tell about ourselves, the myths we tell about ourselves, aren't just things that we can make up. They have to have some kind of grounding in material reality. So if we can kind of shift, you know, one way of shifting the story that's plausible to tell about ourselves is, you know, shifting material conditions, shifting the kind of stories that's possible to tell. So, you know, again, I'm encouraged by the turnout against Doug Ford when he tried to wipe out a major provision of the Charter for collective bargaining rights. And I guess I'm encouraged by that because, you know, Canadians didn't show up for that because they just had a better story about themselves. They showed up because of the conditions that made it possible to have a higher unionization rate in this country, a significantly higher unionization rate in this country than the U.S. So that's just one example that stories that can be supportive of democracy don't come out of nowhere. They don't just come up because we would like to have them. They have to have some kind of grounding in reality. So I do think that's where we get into the concrete issues. That is where we get into the fact that we are going to have a conservative government in this country sometime very soon. You know, maybe in the next election, maybe in the election after that, but in a virtually two-party system, that's guaranteed to happen at some point in the future, or at least it should, because, you know, alternation in power is the lifeblood of a two-party system.
If the polling is correct, it's going to happen within the next 2 years.
For sure. So I think the question is not, you know, is Canada ever going to be governed by conservatives? It's what kind of constraints and barriers and People being willing to stand up and get in the streets to protect those public goods, are they going to face when they're in power? So I guess one thing that I'd like to come from this is galvanizing people a little bit to say that American politics didn't get to this point simply because of Trump. Trump is much more a symptom than a cause. American